Welcome to Faith Element Podcast for May 14th, 2017, focusing on Acts 7:55 through 60, Killing Stephen. I'm Nikki Hardiman.
I'm Bert Montgomery.
I'm David Adams.
I'm sitting here in the host's chair because our fearless leader, David Cassidy, can't be with us this week. And he'll join us again in a couple of weeks. So we are delighted to also welcome to the show tonight, Sarah Harrington Jones, who serves as the minister for children at Central Baptist Church in Lexington, Kentucky. And she is also a seminary student at the Baptist Seminary of Kentucky.
I'm delighted to be here.
Sarah, we're so glad that you're here joining us. So tonight, David Adams is going to kick us off with an introduction to the text.
Sometimes I fantasize about having the time to write books and study things. And one of the things I'm really interested in right now is the idea of engaging in millennialism. The church has always spent a lot of time and effort trying to spread the good news of Jesus Christ. And in various ways, this idea is that people will accept and live this good news. And if they give you this idea, this good news means good things for you and your afterlife, or even people like you as they struggle through life. At the same time, I don't know that we've done such a great job of sharing the bad news of Jesus Christ. And I'm feeling increasingly called to address that. What's the bad news, you might ask? The bad news is that Jesus did not come to make you rich. He did not come to provide you with some sort of spiritual cover for doing all those things you would have done anyway. He didn't come to support your favorite television pundit or political candidate. He's not here to help you come up with a reason for ignoring all those Old Testament passages, you know, the ones that tell you that you have to accept and take care of the foreigners that live among you. He's not here to help you feel that you're better than other people who claim not to follow him. He's not here to incite wars. He's not here to ensure that white men will get better treatment. And he's definitely not here for you to use as a reason to hate, exclude, oppress, and otherwise marginalize people. It has been said that we like our Jesus good and dead, where he can't make demands on us. But I say, Jesus is alive, and he does make demands, even though most of those demands aren't for the kinds of things that support our lifestyles and worldviews. The bad news of Jesus Christ is that he's not likely to be happy with many of the things we do while claiming to be his followers. And we can't just gloss this over by not talking about it or by distracting people with tales of riches to be gained by embracing the things we've been told about him. There's bound to be a sermon in there somewhere, but I'll leave that to poorly paid professionals like Bert. The Bible tells us that shortly after Jesus was taken up to heaven, his early followers of the way, who didn't have the audacity to call themselves Christians for some time yet, lived a radically different lifestyle than we do today. Theirs was a community of the poor, in many senses of the word, that fended for itself and ultimately selected people to ensure that those people on the margins of their own group were taken care of. Stephen was one of those people through whom this group happened. One possible meaning, by the way, of the Greek word diakonos. And the experience of serving others in his community so filled his heart that it overflowed a bit, and he leaked out onto a group of some of the folks who were in the religious mainstream of the town. He ended up sharing some of the bad news of Jesus Christ, and the religious mainstream of his town did what religious mainstreams do when confronted with unpleasant truth. They responded with anger that cascaded into violence. And the followers of the way had their first witness, another Greek word that we pronounce as martyr, to the fact that there have been people throughout history who don't like their religious thought to get too real. The irony of this whole outrageous affair is that the guy who held their cloaks so they could get a little more velocity on their rocks was a guy named Saul. Stephen clearly got under his skin to the point of obsession, and he kept acting out this hostility until Jesus himself came to him on the road to Damascus and set him straight. He spent the rest of his life trying to make sense of all this, but his struggles with faith, which you can argue started here, shaped the way all of us have come to know Jesus. Everyone likes to be comfortable and peaceful in their religious views. As Terry Taylor once put it in the song, Angels Tuck You In, you hold an image that provides a common thread. No sense of menace, no feelings of dread. You never worry your pretty little head, and angels tuck you in tonight. That's the religion we want, and we're obviously willing to fight to keep it. Stephen wasn't the first person to provoke a violent reaction by shaking up some complacent holier-than-you believers, and there are plenty of people who are doing this today. Like it or not, the folks who are willing to question our drive to be comfortable, and really, what makes us more comfortable than the idea that we're better than somebody else and have a right to act however we want? Those people who make us uncomfortable are the future of faith. The rest of us have no future. And to quote Terry again, "You've been a wide-eyed innocent. Come to the garden. Come to the hill. Come to the tree. Come to the kill. Won't break your bones, but it can break your will."
Wow. David, that reminded me so much of one of my heroes, and I think he's one of yours too, the late, great Mike Iaconelli, founder of Youth Specialties, great author and speaker, and he used to say that Jesus, in contrast to all the success gospels, and not just the prosperity gospel, but just the general evangelical ploy that Jesus is going to make your life better and you need Jesus, and he would say, Jesus comes to ruin your life, you know, that Jesus is going to turn everything upside down, and you're going to have to give up all of your prosperity and all your me, and all your my power over this. And kind of like what you said, all the stuff about loving and caring for the foreigners and the aliens and the widows and the orphans. And, you know, that just kind of ruins our whole cultural idea of what Christ is about. And it can get us in trouble.
I think it's interesting, too, that this isn't necessarily just a Christian phenomenon. I mean, people from many other religions have done the same thing. You know, they go along, they're complacent, they're happy, and then one day someone stands up and tells them the way things really should be, or tries to bring them back to the roots that started this religion in the first place. And things just don't typically go well for them when they do that.
Yeah, you know, when you said that, I immediately thought of Malcolm X when he came back from his visit to Mecca, and all of a sudden he realized that the Nation of Islam and its black, exclusive black nationalism really wasn't true to the Quran or the spirit of Islam. And, you know, for the best of my knowledge, the general accepted theory is that it was members of the Nation of Islam who assassinated him.
I was really struck, David, in your introduction when you said, when you talked about how those of us who are wanting that comfortable faith are not the future of faith, but rather those who are shaking things up, who are making us uncomfortable, are the future. And I kind of would love to hear you talk a little bit more about that.
Well, mostly when I'm thinking about that, I'll just give a brief thing that Bert's very well aware of because he's a sociology person. But there is Max Weber has a theory of groups. And one of the things that they talk about in there is the way groups work is that they have a big moment where something large happens, something outside of the norm that shatters their worldview, that disrupts everything. And that transforms people and transforms the world in a special way. And typically what happens in groups of people after they've had that moment, it calls people and they want to follow it. But over time, they get complacent or they want to have it happen the same way every time. Or they want to discourage innovations in this because they like so much the original vision they had that they can't understand that visions are supposed to grow and evolve. And because of that, you eventually plateau out and you stop attracting people and you stop having that vitality you used to have. And frequently you even go into decline and it gets worse and worse and people get hopeless and hostile and even bitter and angry. And if you're lucky, you get disrupted again. And when you do, things change and you move forward to a future. If you're not lucky, you don't get disrupted again. You just die out. A friend of mine, who I shouldn't mention him on the air because he probably doesn't want me using his name in vain.
Yes.
But we had a long conversation one time when he just flat out asked me, why would you work at a seminary? Why would you want to teach another
That's
generation?
That's a good question.
He said, why would you want to? Yeah. Why would you want to teach another generation of ministers? Why would you want to do this? You know where the church is going, and it's not a good place because people have done things that are killing it. You know, they've lost a sense of vision and excitement and vitality that they used to have because they want things to be status quo, and they're not willing to disrupt anything anymore. So he asked me why I would continue to do that. And the only thing I could think to say to him at the time was, Well, you know, sometimes you have to just do ministry and helping things that are beyond their time and are in desperation and loneliness, helping them to die sometimes is a very good form of pastoral care. And someone's got to be there for them when that happens. It beat using the tar pits metaphor anyway.
You're talking about these disruptions that are absolutely necessary. And yet, I think that's another reason that you may be at a seminary. I know that's why I'm in a seminary, to help me learn how to better embrace the disruptions of life and in ministry, or even as lay people in our churches, to help others embrace these changes and look out ahead. Because like you said, without it, we die and our faith dies and we lose our imagination and we grow stagnant.
David, I think what I heard you saying, like this is interesting to me. And I like you said, if we're lucky enough, we get disrupted. I'm kind of mulling over that, sitting here thinking about that. I think that so often the church has taken this approach of disruptions are something to be tolerated. Maybe we even respond to them and figure out how to work them into who we are. Like if we are tolerant enough, or if we are, you know, progressive enough, we might figure out how to do that. But that's not what I hear you saying. I hear you saying that disruptions are a gift, which is a very different way to think about them. I think that thinking of a disruption as something to be tolerated and solved is very different from thinking of a disruption or a disruptor, if we're thinking about Stephen in this story, as a gift and as an act of grace from God. And that, coupled with the other thing you were talking about with groups, I think is really helpful when we talk about the church and what the church is doing. You talked about how that groups want to maintain this status quo. They want to keep things even, but the groups that continue to grow and continue, I think I might be putting words in your mouth here, but it sounded to me like the groups that continue to grow and have vitality continue to update their vision. They continue to grow in how they see what their role is and what their job is and what their purpose is. And I don't know, all of that is a lot more hopeful than the idea of figuring out how to tolerate or deal with or solve some kind of disruption.
Well, it sounds hopeful, but when you're in it, it doesn't feel very hopeful.
No, it doesn't.
Oddly, some of the stuff I've been telling you about is, if you've had my leadership class, and two of you have, you know, there's a thing, I draw this all out on the board and we talk about this. But if you're that person who's bringing disruption and challenging the status quo and making things different, you're going to get a lot of flack. And your life is not going to be easy. You know, they're going to hate you for that. And it may be several years after you're gone before anyone appreciates anything you've done at all. But if you're not there doing it, then who else is going to do it? I love reading this passage and thinking that how Peter and Paul and Stephen and all the people of that era that came in, they were massively disruptive. They were saying outrageous things in a world where you could much more easily than today be killed for having a difference of opinion. And they didn't let that stop them. The whole book of Acts is interesting to me because you have so many disruptors in there that they, I don't know if they even saw themselves that way. They saw themselves as people who did what was necessary, what God called them to do. But they did an enormous amount of what you could call social damage, I would guess, in an era where the Roman Empire was in charge, where disrupting the peace was pretty much the worst crime you could commit. And here they were, regardless, they're going to disrupt things because that's what they were called to do. And even if you get past that story, you're thinking, wow, this is something that happened almost 2,000 years ago and we're still talking about it. Hmm. You know, so that's really disruptive.
Hmm.
I don't know how we got from where that's the way we're supposed to start things and the way we're supposed to live to where suddenly that's something we're supposed to resist. Or maybe we can tuck it into a nice category someplace where you don't have to pay much attention to it. You know, but I think when we did that, we lost a lot of energy.
I'm reminded of a situation that happened in a congregation some years ago where there was a man who was struggling with mental illness and was on the streets, didn't have a home, wandered into a congregation where I was. And, you know, he was really met with resistance. And he wasn't just, you know, there to preach on the side of the road or stand up for, for Christ, but his very presence was disruptive because we didn't like our furniture being sat on by somebody who's dirty. It caused problems because he burped at the table. How do we invite him into a family meal on Wednesday night and he doesn't have any manners? And his very presence was disruptive. And there was grace enough with a few people who, because several, to be honest, wanted to send him on his way. But there were a few people who made space and he came back and he continued to come back. And he became a part of that community. And it ruffled some feathers and it looked different. But by the time he left, the community itself was different. And, you know, we didn't stone him, but it was a different way of looking at this in church, that it's not always just the person who's carrying the gospel, carrying the banner, moving us forward. But sometimes within our own communities, how do we deal with this disruption or a disruptor to our status quo?
And we have to face it. We're not all that great about dealing with people who are different anyway.
No.
You know, and if you really want to see, I think, Sarah, you hit the nail on the head here. If you really want to see disruption, see what happens when somebody who has what we would call a disability wants to be an active part of what a congregation does and see how that works for them. You know, it usually isn't very pretty because it just doesn't fit into the nice, comfortable categories that we have. And we don't have a way of dealing with it. And we're uncomfortable. We do some things that we're not really proud of.
Well, and it forces us to have to work. We kind of like this comfortable Christianity. And we kind of got this thing where we can show up on Sunday, roll through Sunday school, do our little worship time and pat ourselves on the back. Some of us might come back on Wednesday night and it's all good. And what happens when we have someone who has mental illness or who needs us to take them home or who has a learning disability? Or any number of other things, we have to accommodate and think about the other person and be challenged to learn something new. And it's hard when we're busy and sometimes we just want to write them off and then we're shoving them to the side.
Yeah. And there are lots of ways that our comfortable Christianity can be challenged and disruptive. And one of them is this idea of having to stop being on autopilot, to having to think, okay, how do I make room and space for this person who's different than me? But then sometimes it comes in the form of, like it did with Stephen, where the disruptor is saying, I don't think y'all are getting it right. I think that y'all are kind of flat out wrong. And so it challenges us to look at how we are doing Christianity. And are we really following in the way of Christ and what Christ calls us to, or are we following in the way that makes us comfortable and satisfied and gives us a good, warm, fuzzy feeling?
And I'll say something even more disruptive, I guess, which is I don't know that we're comfortable following Christ so much as following things we've said about Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if time came for us to do exactly what Jesus told us to do, there are very few, especially American Christians, that could pull it off or would want to. You know, but as long as we're comfortable with our culture and we can be culturally Christian, not too hard on us. You know, we can still have some people there being a part of it, not worrying too much because no one's going to give us these dangerous ideas.
Mm-hmm. And we still have we still have that group bloodlust, don't we? That we've got to humiliate, we've got to tear down, we've got to attack, we've got to maybe physically assault the people, and feel good in our faith for doing it. Maybe we need to realize, you know, maybe the story of Stephen is as much in the contemporary church for us. Is the story of the stoners, not stoners, but stoners. You know what I mean? because, I mean, we've got a rich history. God's people have a rich history of believing that we've got to protect God and we've got to defend God. And it's our job to make sure God doesn't get hurt. And anyone that is threatening to us or offending us, well, obviously, they are threatening and offending God, and it's our responsibility to deal with it. So, you know, we're always on the lookout to verbally attack people, publicly humiliate, discredit, and in some cases, violently attack or destroy, and feel good about our faith in the process. But, you know, like Bob Dylan said, if I could take a paraphrase of Bob Dylan, I wouldn't feel so all alone because all of us want to stone somebody. You know, the leader stoned Stephen, Jewish folks threw Jeremiah in the well. And, you know, some of us may not remember a time, or some of our older ancestors remember a time when anybody who spoke openly of keeping blacks in their place, you know, they may not have been the one who tied the nooses around the necks, but, you know, we spoke out and attacked people who dared threatened our white religion here in Mississippi and across the South and across the country. So, you know, I don't know, but I think we're all, maybe the story pulls out what's it saying to all of us as stoners. I like using that word. You know, that we're always trying to protect God. And, you know, the one that was there, I think you mentioned this in the opening, a young man, well, a man named Saul was there watching this, watching the whole thing happen. And Frederick Buechner points out that, you know, a stoning isn't a very quick, easy, nice little thing. And it takes a while. And it starts with a few rocks. It starts with a few broken fragments of a rock. And it takes a while to tear the man down and get him down. And then, you know, you got to keep stoning until he's dead. And, it, you know, this is why they stripped down to the waist. And they had big, heavy men with strong muscles who could throw heavy rocks doing it. And somebody collecting all the coats to make sure, watching everything while it was going on to hold stuff for the big, strong guys to do this. And Saul was one of those guys, but it was something that Saul never forgot. And I guess the hope that I find in this story is that there's hope for all of us stoners. And if there's hope for Paul, maybe there's hope that we can overcome our fear of others, and that we can overcome our fear of other sins, whatever they might be, or heresies, or whatever enemies we've got, that like Paul, who eventually, you know, Paul later, we can put down our stones.
I think it starts with us individually, though. It's so easy to do this collectively as American Christians, but it really begins like where Saul had that impression made on him. How do we take that in our own lives when we are challenged by a minister or the homeless person who comes in the door or someone who says, hey, I think you're wrong about this. I wish you would think more broadly on whatever issue it is. And instead of picking up our stone, how do we individually respond? And then how does that affect, again, collectively, the church at large? And I think there's a lot of hope when we look at it from Saul's perspective that he, you know, this did make an impression, but even he was not past redemption. But it was one person, and I'm one person, and you're one person. And what is our one role in this larger conversation?
I don't know where to fit this in. We might shuffle the narrative a little bit because I like what Bert just said, but something that you might note when you're dealing with children especially, but with actually people of all ages, is that much of the time when we get violent, when we get out of control, when we act inappropriately, that comes from a place not necessarily of us being bad people so much as there are many times we're put in a situation where we don't have the proper vocabulary or understanding of something to deal with it. We just can't deal with it. It's more than we can comprehend. And typically, especially among children, their way of reacting to this tends to be to act out in a very physical way, you know, in a loud, annoying way, sometimes a violent way. But there are a lot of times we'll say someone's a bad child or a bad teenager or a bad person. And what they're really doing is not being aggressive and cruel so much as trying to communicate in some way, trying to find some way to overcome this disequilibrium they're feeling where they just don't have words and they don't know what to do. And I think in a faith setting, especially, well, the story of Stephen's one of those, he hit them with some pretty heavy stuff. And they probably didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you can almost see these people struggling with that. And there were probably, yes, there's some that removed the violence. And I think once the violence got going, it was easy for people to chime in because, oh, here's something we know how to do. Let's just go do that. Let's go along with that because at least it makes sense what they're doing. You know, but maybe some of this whole thing about disruption is the fact that we sometimes do get ourselves pushed into positions where we just don't have the equipment to deal with what's going on with us. And maybe we need to focus, if we look at this as a ministerial task, maybe we should focus on finding ways to help people get those tools, to find ways to talk to each other and not have to resort to this kind of violence.
I concur. I took a phone call this afternoon from a young woman in our congregation who had been challenged by a similar situation. Something happened out in public that was startling to her, and she was questioning her reaction because it was fierce and it was angry, and she felt very threatened, you know, and kind of mama bear-ish. And in that moment, you know, she said, next time I'll know how to do better, but I didn't think about this. How would I respond? And how do I respond as a Christian and that this happened? And maybe you're onto something, David, that we can think, maybe, you know, in other situations, we talk about role play from emotions or how to greet somebody or how to have appropriate behavior, but we're not really doing that in our churches and in a ministerial role. You know, why aren't we role playing? What does this look like when somebody comes at you? I mean, I know there was a lot of training that went on, you know, when there were sit-ins and, you know, how to be nonviolent and model this nonviolent behavior. We can start doing that with some of our younger kids and even our adults.
I'm seeing like a teaching grownups how to use their words. Yes. Right? That's what we tell children, right? Use your words, not your hands, right? All of this has been a really interesting conversation to me. And I found myself thinking, you know, I've never thrown a stone. I've never, you know, physically harmed someone. But I also know I am not exempt from this. I'm a part of Christianity and I am complicit by my participation.
Yes. Yes. I think sometimes we need to even acknowledge that sometimes our stones are the ways that we have a void. We create a void from not answering what's going on. We're hurting, we're doing injury, not by hurling some horrible slogan at someone, but rather by not speaking up. Those are stones to injury. So when someone is hurting or for some reason doesn't have an advocate for their financial or their home or mental health or whatever their problem is, whatever they're dealing with, whatever their struggle is, and we just want to placate them, oh, we'll pray for you. But we're really not ready to get into the grime with them and walk with them. We're actually throwing a stone of neglect. I think we injure by not being present just as much as we injure by being present in their face.
And we can all think of people that we've denied inclusion to.
Absolutely.
Probably personally and collectively. I heard someone say one time, when we say all are welcome, all means all. And a lot of times in our churches, I think all does not mean all.
I don't know. Maybe we could, maybe you could say something about, can we even imagine what it looks like from both sides? Can we put ourselves in both sides or all three? So if we're imagining ourselves in the story, and clearly we're the church and we don't want to receive the disruptive, really hard stuff that's coming at us, whether it's the person themselves or the message that's being told to us. Can we imagine how do we do that? In what ways are we in that role? And then how are we maybe to see ourselves as Saul, the person who is changed by this? Yeah, we've acted in a very bad way, but what can we take from this and change and open our hearts, crack our hearts wide open. And then from Stephen, you know, it's easy to say he was a martyr, but Stephen was in control. He wasn't curled down. I mean, the CEV version says that he knelt down and he was praying even in that moment. So he remained in prayer with God. And so I just wonder how we can imagine ourselves in each of these roles. Go do something with that.
Find more information about this podcast, as well as videos and teaching resources for this session at faithelement.net. Faith Element is a service of Faith Lab.